Chapter for Eargant Society. I should try to sum up a number of my conclusions. Eargants and humans would seem to be totally different beings, but in fact the only real difference is a body that is adapted to life on their respective planet. Other differences are caused by different upbringing and environmental effects, but intellectually and emotionally we are about the same. If a Eargant were to be born on Earth, he would become a normal human being, and if a human were to be born on Eargant, he would become a normal Eargant. So, if this is true, how do we account for the vast difference in mentality? The over-socialized community that eliminates all discrimination and aggression would demand a tremendous improvement in human mentality, otherwise it would be misused by the greedy and the lazy. It demands a race with a high degree of unselfishness. Am I to understand from this, that Eargant's secret lies in a perfect method of bringing up children? No, due to her planetary conditions, Eargant has a different cycle of evolution than the Earth. Due to this, we have the ability to continually improve our mentality through many generations. Eargant's secret is that we are bound by the law of cause and effect and are therefore subject to reincarnation selection. This law lost its validity on Earth long ago. On Earth, the weeds grow up with the corn until the harvest, and then the selection takes place. Because of this, mankind cannot improve her mentality. You are still troubled by the demonic element of human dualism and there is no escape. On Eargant, on the other hand, the weeds are constantly removed, which neutralizes the demonic element. Naturally, the children's upbringing plays a large part in the mental attitude, but it is not the cause of the improvement. Your supposition that a human born on Eargant would grow into a normal Eargant is incorrect. In the first place, he would not have taken part in the reincarnation cycle of Eargant, and what is more, his character would not fit. Due to the planet conditions, a human is willful and disobedient. He obeys no god, no commandment, and no conscience. He even pretends that he doesn't have one. He knows everything better. I hope that we never have to accept one of these beings into our system. It would be a terrible mistake, without counting the damage it would do to his surroundings. A large dose of unselfishness can only exist in an environment that is protected from evil. You see that it is not as simple as you think. Great gods, what have I got myself into? More or less by accident I seem to ask a relevant question, and during the answer I hear expressions that are meaningless to me. What am I supposed to make of expressions such as reincarnation selection, evolution cycle, and demonic dualism? To answer this we will have to explain the whole plan of creation. Is this what you want? Certainly. Excellent, but we will have to change the nature of our explanation. Before long, something exceptional is going to happen. The Earth's isolation will be broken. The exchange of information between intelligent races will take place, and this is bound by stringent rules and conditions. The first rule is that such exchange must be preceded by an identification procedure in which credentials are exchanged. Next to the physical confrontation, this demands an illustrated description of the planet and the type, evolution, and history of the race. Normally this takes place during exchange visits, which implies the capability of space flight, but in your case a different procedure will have to be followed. You will visit Eargant only in the mind by means of a special system that we have established. The pictures that you have stored in your memory are real, and not from a film. We possess the power of mind over matter, as you also will within a short time. Before we can begin with the explanation of the plan of creation, we must complete the identification. You must know who we are, where we come from, and what our intentions are. We already know these details of mankind, because we have access to the source of human knowledge, or if you prefer it, the spirit of man, where all human thoughts and experiences are determined. We know your thoughts too. Now I realize that you started this identification process already from the beginning. I can't think of any other explanation for this detailed description of yours. Did you know how this conversation was going to turn out before we began? Yes. Time and matter are creations out of the void and are therefore composed of pure contradictions that leave the original infinity intact. Therefore, They do not really exist. The timeless consciousness that sent us here knew who we would find here, and what he would do with the information. Every detail of every human life is known in advance. Then this meeting was no accident? Most certainly. The goal of creation would be impossible if coincidence did not exist. A coincidence just happens, and is therefore free. The fact that a timeless consciousness in a non-material existence knows the outcome of the coincidences in advance, changes nothing in the freedom of the coincidence. For us you are, and will remain, a coincidence, even when we know roughly what will take place. Your freedom remains undamaged. Should you decide to leave now, nobody would attempt to stop you. If you decide not to use the information you will receive, you are perfectly free, nobody will compel you. I reserve my comments. May we continue? Since we have now received your freely given consent, we can intensify the further transfer of information. You will be induced to sleep, and when you awake, you will recollect a very lengthy lecture in which you have gathered a wealth of information. The strangest thing about this is that I remember nothing of falling asleep or waking up. If they had not told me about it, I would have noticed nothing except that something had gone wrong with the time. All the information that I can remember so clearly, would normally have taken weeks to gather. I realized later that the exercise must have been completed in about 1.5 hours. It is a casual demonstration of their power to manipulate the human mind, their power of mind over matter that will be explained in the second part of this book. It confirms my first feelings during the confrontation, the fear you feel when you know you are helpless. Even these steel walls cannot protect me from this intelligent pressure group. Some kind of primitive instinct warned me. I wonder if my participation in this meeting was as voluntary as they would have me believe. The mental pressure that was put upon me, especially in the second part of the conversation, certainly gave me my doubts. Now, after many years, the doubts have gone. The question of my freedom during the confrontation is no longer of importance. The question now is, if I am free in the use of the information, and the answer to this is yes. No person or situation has exerted any kind of pressure to influence my decision in whether or not to publish the information. Having completed this note, I will continue with the real purpose of this book, and relate the information that has been burned into my memory. During this, I will ignore the dialogue form, and concentrate more on the efficiency of reporting. The subject is the further development of the Eargon race and in particular the birth of the superculture. Their definition of the word civilization or culture has nothing to do with the scientific or technological development level, but with the manner in which the community takes care of the handicapped or weaker beings. This is exactly as the Danish, Klæsing editor Martinus 1890-1981, says, a civilization's stage of evolution can be measured in how the society takes care of the weak and sickly ones in the society. Adotto. Comment. The word superculture defines the situation that arises when through individual effort, a group's structure has arisen which abolishes any discrimination against any individual. It is of the greatest importance not to forget that this situation was only possible due to the fact that the reincarnation selection exists on Eargo which roots out the adepts of evil. This is therefore an environment which is protected from the influence of evil. This development is also of importance to us, because we will also develop a superculture one day. This Earth-adapted version will develop during the approaching Kingdom of Peace and Justice after the resurrection selection. The things described here in connection with the identification procedure are only the developments themselves. The background causes can only be dealt with in Part 2. The description of this development fits in perfectly with the previous explanations. The universal economic system shows itself in practice to be an efficient production system of goods and services, placing prior importance in the sectors housing, nutrition and transport. The produce is then shared by simply controlling the individual use or consumption. The aim of this system is to free the individual as much as possible from non-creative, servile work. As soon as the production reaches a point of overproduction, the work day is shortened, which allows more time for creative pursuits. The importance that they place in creativeness deserves some explanation. They see the purpose of their existence as threefold. 1. The creation of their individual identity. This occurs more or less automatically by being born, by living, and by working. Immortality by the use of their talents. They stimulate each other's activities by attempting to reach self-chosen creative goals. They think that they live on in their works, in their creativity. 3. The choice of their second identity, being the culmination of their daily choice between selfish and unselfish creativity. This determines whether the individual will take part in the formation of a godly or ungodly consciousness. This conviction is the cause of their unbridled pursuit of creativity in the broadest meaning of the word. The first assignment is fulfilled automatically so that the second becomes the most important. The search for unselfishness comes later. This resulted in a dominant interest in freeing themselves for individual creativity. With this idea in mind, they created a highly efficient, almost completely automated production system. Next, they sought to reduce the consumption of goods and services by appealing to the self-discipline, in order to attain a reduction in production or an increase in population. Eventually, they reached the situation in which everyone, without exception, had only to work for one day in the week on the direct production process. The voluntary constraint of consumption and the equality of the non-creative work output lead automatically to the equalization of incomes. People waive, Frafola, their right to consume and their needs decrease. Then comes the great moment in the development of the Eargon race. The control on consumption is lifted. All goods and services are freely available to all, above a certain age. The individual self-discipline has come of age, material greed has been conquered. The Eargons look upon this as the beginning of the superculture. Free access to all this prosperity, for everyone, makes it impossible for an individual to be wanting when compared to others. This is the welfare state without discrimination, that takes care of you from the cradle to the grave, that we, lacking the selection, can never create on earth. Never, Martinus means it will take long time, at least 500 years to reach this level here on earth. Rocum, what a shame, human beings cradled in the warmth of unselfishness would be wondrous. Happiness and satisfaction means reaching the goal of your creativeness together with others, as long as this strengthens the feeling of self-respect. This can only work as long as there are none of the types that always want all of the glory for themselves, and this makes great demands on the leaders of any creative project. This is obviously only a part of their battle to eliminate the spiritual or immaterial backlog. It is impossible to describe this comprehensive system of caring for each other, simply because it is so far removed from what we regard as possible. I think that it may be impossible for many people to imagine such a situation, and I can perhaps better confine myself to a description of some of the end results. A superculture can be recognized by its unbridled creative power. It is unbelievable what a dedicated group can attain in a short time when no time has to be wasted on control or supervision. It is the heyday of science, technology, and art. Laboratories and observatories are built and they discovered the secrets of the universe. Their creativeness builds gigantic spacecraft which operate on reaction-free power. They built submarines for the exploration of their oceans. Their knowledge knows no bounds. They develop a strong affinity for beauty, which manifests itself in numerous artifacts. The central gardens in the house cylinders change into complete art exhibitions that attract a constant flow of visitors. Their designs especially show their affinity with the creator and the universe. Half-abstract art forms illustrate the details of creation's beauty. A kind of religious art form. They are continually occupied and demonstrate an activity that astounds the earthly observer. This can also be said of the speed with which the one discovery follows the other. This appears to have no connection with the fact that they are highly intelligent, but because they have the ability to tune into cosmic vibrations, the ancient knowledge of the Creator. They call this the ability of final contemplation, a state of mind that they can reach as a group. It is impossible for us to reach this stadium for some time, The Iagan evolution cycle is a closed circuit in which external interference is excluded. They are self-supporting because they obey a godly law. They are aware of their dependence on an almighty creation plan, the Word. They obtain the knowledge that we can only learn from others. This is why the races with an open cycle are helped by the races with a closed cycle of evolution. This short description should make it clear that the following description of the final contemplation is purely a part of the identification process, very essential, but for us purely a curiosity, at least for the moment. It is one of the sweet fruits of a very high level of unselfishness. I was witness to a bizarre happening in the garden of one of the house cylinders. Some 100 Iagans sat or lay in a moss-covered hollow about 30 meters across. This amphitheater arrangement afforded them all a view of a kind of abstract statue placed in the middle of the hollow. It was a hub with a series of shafts, on which were mounted about 10 spoked, wheel-like objects. A man and a woman were, as artists, engaged in attaching colored globes to the ends of the spokes. Beside them, a man addressed the gathering. Wide-eyed, I observed this colorful gathering that was engaged in a remarkable kind of touching, and ceremony. Left, right, and center, all were lying or sitting in, as far as we are concerned, intimate poses, looking and listening. This took place in the early stages of their superculture. They used a simple method of teaching their riper youth to develop their powers of finer contemplation, and these had been prepared for this evening by a day of special activities and mental training. The orator in the middle of the group concentrated their thoughts on the object by means of questions, the purpose being that everyone present would feel the answer at the moment of the ecstatic climax. The contemplation training is aimed at the development of a strong collective thought power, a matter-controlling power, through mutual concentration on a visual object, in this case a kind of electronic fire that had to be synchronized by their power of thought. The orator had ended his questions, and now made a gesture in the direction of a number of musicians seated at some long, low instruments. These placed their fingers on the 10 keys of the instrument and began to press them in and out in a certain rhythm, and at the same time, move them from left to right and back again. Each set of 5 keys could move independently, a sort of movable piano keyboard. The gathering reacted immediately. They sat straight up with their legs crossed and their hands on the shoulders or knees of the person next to them. 7 women dressed in transparent blue veils stood up from the front row and formed a ring around the central object. The artists that had decorated the object seated themselves at another piece of equipment that also had keys, fitted in discs that could tilt as well as turn. Then the lights went out and they were seated in darkness. I had slowly but surely become used to seeing strange situations. But this was the climax of the Iagan series. The object began to move. It turned in its vertical axis, and the individual spoke systems each turned on its own axis, while tilting at the same time. The globes at the end of the spokes began to throw off sparks as if they were glowing hot. Then the sparks began to form a haze and sprung over between the wheels until the whole 2-meter-high object was transformed into a turbulent ball of fire. The intensity of the light increased, and the original blue-white color changed into a fantastic color composition of boiling waves of individual spots of orange, red, yellow, green, blue, and white. At points where spots of the same color touched each other, blinding flashes appeared. The final result is best described as a blinding, boiling fireball, that illuminated the surroundings with intense flashes of multicolored light. The 7 veiled women danced with jerky movements to the rhythm of the music, such a graceful, refined, perfectly coordinated dance, that I can only call it staggering. Their transparent veils and their glass-like skin seemed to absorb the light flashes to such an extent that it seemed as if they themselves were emitting a constantly changing glow of light. The haughty concentration with which they performed their dance made them seem like supernatural beings, elevated far above the material. The gathering watched the fire dance in deep concentration, moving slightly to the beat of the music. The turbulence and flashing of the globes began to take on a more regular pattern. Suddenly, the lights formed into colored bands and the flashing ceased. At that moment a shock ran through the gathering. They seemed to increase their concentration on the fireball. The music stopped and the dancers stood like statues. Deadly silence. Suddenly, the flashes of light began again, but this time in the colored bands, and in a controlled pattern of movement. This was the supreme moment at which their powers of contemplation manifested themselves invisibly. Their collective thought power was used to compel Tvint, the two operators of the electronic fire, to perform the fast and faultless actions that were needed to synchronize the colors, something that is impossible to do alone. As soon as the synchronization was accomplished, the two operators removed their hands from the controls and the necessary control was performed purely by the thought power of the group. This continued for several minutes. The impression that all this made on me was almost destructive. I was in such a state of confusion that I nearly lost control of myself and was at the point of fainting. Only later did I realize why I reacted in this way. I was a real witness to the happening. It wasn't the sight of all this that so disturbed me, but the direct experience of their willpower. Their thoughts had to control the confusing electronic fire, and they had to transmit exceptionally strong impulses which only served to confuse me. It is good that we do not yet possess these powers. They would only make things more difficult for us. On the other hand, it made it clearer to me how they can heal people by the power of thought. It is a power that moves every sinew in your body. The principle of the fine and contemplation is more difficult to understand. They state that the creative power of man is not personal, but something that he has borrowed for a time. It is a reflection of the ever-present creativity field that I call the omni-creativity. Totally. It was the power of the Creator, and as such, Almighty. Now it is available as an impersonal consciousness component that waits for the intelligent races to use it. By using it, it becomes a personal consciousness component by which personalities are created that have the power of mind over matter. One who has reached this level is capable of omni-creative contacts without the aid of a group, and then has the ability of final contemplation. They describe the contemplative climax as the feeling as if the skull opens and the thoughts take wing into an unbounded space. It can also be described as the mind entering the presence of the blinding light of truth and cherishing warmth. Et slag skolt of tkosmisk glimt. Rokom. The physical sensation is described as a moment of shuddering ecstatic happiness. No words can fully describe the sensation of coming face to face with the source of all knowledge and wisdom. The being will then approach a condition of all knowledge and all wisdom through multiple repetitions of contemplative contacts. This is in fact the beginning of the cosmic integration process, taking part in a new godly consciousness. To attain this, the person must have freely and irrevocably chosen for it, and freed himself from his demonic consciousness component. In other words, he must have passed the selection. We have not yet done this, and it is therefore beyond our reach. The reason for this premature explanation, it really belongs in the second part of this book, is to give the reader some idea of how the Eargons obtained the knowledge of the creation plan in which they instruct others. It can also serve to aid the understanding of the Eargon cycle of evolution as a part of the identification process. How the final contemplation binds a race of billions of beings, who differ little from us, into a homogeneous group that knows only one goal, the perfection of their society by mutual love, so that the whole race, including the slower ones, is capable of taking part in the omni-creative integration process. This longing for absolute values creates a mutual bond, so dominant, that a situation of collective consciousness replaces the individual. In this last phase of the superculture, the Eargon race reaches such a high grade of love, knowledge, and wisdom, such a level of perfection that it is impossible for us to imagine. Even less imaginable is that we too will one day reach the same level. For the rest of the identification procedure, I refer you to the second part, because it is impossible to separate it from the explanation of the plan of creation. The real reason for their visit was, as has been said, the planting of information, describing the future of the Earth and the reason for the external interference that will disturb the authority and sovereignty of the human race. This information has been placed in the second part of this book and, in this, has misplaced the sequence of the original conversation. The next two chapters clearly belong in the introduction and contribute to the identification, they therefore belong in the first part, according to my feelings. I have chosen to use the dialogue form again because this conforms with the reality. It is in fact the farewell ceremony which took place when I awoke from my trance. Chapter 5 The Argon Spacecraft. We will now keep the promise we made at the beginning of this meeting and show you our spacecraft. The screen showed a new picture in space with thousands of stars in the endless black depths of the cosmos. In the middle hung four shining round disks, spaced at regular intervals and exactly in line. A moment later these objects turned slowly and I was able to see a side view. I felt a wild triumph welling up inside me. Flying saucers real, live flying saucers. In the side view they had the streamlined profile of a perfect discus with knife-sharp edges. They were marked from above and below with many concentric rings, but windows or any other sign that living beings were on board were nowhere to be seen. Only on the outer right ship was a small projecting cylindrical ridge to be seen, which blindingly reflected the sunlight. They were connected to each other by a cable and apart from this, I could see no other details. How large are those things? You can judge that for yourself. The navigation dome is raised in the last craft and you have walked over it. You don't mean that small shining ridge? Certainly. I was shocked. You would build a villa on that platform. But. Now, let me see. They must be nearly 1,000 feet in diameter. Our compliments on your power of estimation. I was breathless. A supertanker could turn on one of them. Such a monster is surely not here underwater? No, this is a landing unit, a complete spacecraft of much smaller dimensions that can detach itself from the mothership, operate independently in space and land on planets. Why are they so large? They are not so large. We would like to build them bigger, but for safety reasons, each space command consists of five ships. You cannot see the last one here because the film was made by this ship during a coupling maneuver close to Iarga. The ships are connected to each other by a hollow tube containing a lift. We are therefore able to visit each other. Why do they have the discus form? The discus is the final universal form of starships. The main reason is the round form of the propulsion unit, the sun wheels. To give you an idea of this, here is a film. A gigantic, round, factory hall appeared, at least 1200 feet in diameter and with a self-supporting roof construction. One of these craft was under construction. A complicated, star pat and rib construction in which the contours of an enormous discus could dearly be seen. Hundreds of Iargans in orange-colored overalls were working in innumerable floor levels between cranes and other equipment. Close to the outer edge of the discus were two round pipes, each of about 20 feet in diameter and about 12 feet apart, one above the other. Outside this double tube system was a much larger tube with a triangular cross-section, rounded off at the corners. This was connected to the other two tubes by tangential, trumpet-shaped pipes. This ring system was the sun wheel. When I don't understand how a set of tubes can power a spaceship, you can hardly expect me to understand why they must be round. The mass kinetic propulsion principle is understandable to you. In both the round tubes, matter is spun round at relative speed. The direction in each tube is opposite, one left and one right. Oh, I see a sort of cyclotron? Let us say a sort of synchrotron. The outlet principle of a rocket is known to you. Hot gases, or material, is forced out at the highest possible speed. A universal spaceship does in fact do the same thing. Matter is forced out at the speed of light, but not into space. It comes into an anti-mass field, where it simply disappears and falls back as immaterial energy in the cosmic carrier field. Look at this ring system from above and strike a line square at the flight direction through the center point. You then have two diametrically opposite points. At these points and where the material stream is in a backward direction, you set a cosmic laser working, which continually lets the fastest moving particles escape. You then have the same effect as a rocket which blasts material out at the speed of light through to nozzles.